Up next, from the Center for Social Innovation, this week's panel discussion explores business opportunities in the education arena on Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Dagelmeier, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation from Bridging the Gap. Bridging the Gap was the 2005 Net Impact Conference convened by the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
And now, here is our presentation from Bridging the Gap.
I'd like to take a brief few moments to have each of the panelists introduce themselves to you, the work they're currently doing, and their little bit 30-second bio about how they got into for-profit education. Can we start here, Alan?
I've been in this field for a while now. Since 1992, when I founded SCORE Educational Centers right here in Palo Alto, that organization, as some of you know, is now a national company. It's now part of the Washington Post Company. Founded in 1992, I continued with SCORE for a few years after the acquisition, left in 1996. Actually taught part-time here at the Business School and School of Education, sort of as a forerunner to Tony. I worked with Michael Kirst and Sam Wood teaching the course on basically the overview course for the education industry for people doing the joint degree program here. Being back on the college campus, I started to observe some things about the typical experience of an undergraduate student and came up with the idea for Inside Track. That's my current company. At Inside Track, we provide success coaching to college students to help them be more successful, stay in school, and graduate. Only 54% of college students graduate from four-year degree programs, so there's a huge problem there people are not very aware of. We address it.
Good afternoon. I'm Bridget Foster. I'm the Director of Business Development at SchoolNet. SchoolNet is an instructional management system for K-12 education, and with that, we work with a variety of different types of companies that provide content and assessment content and data management for that integrated system. Prior to my work with SchoolNet, I worked with another ed tech company, Plato Learning. I was the director of education for Plato Learning for a year and a half. Been in the private sector only 2 years. Prior to that, I worked in education, in the field of education, as a teacher and administrator for 14 years and 6 years with the Department of Education here in California.
Hi, I'm Dennis Doyle, co-founder of SchoolNet. You may wonder why I've come to Stanford today. Well, I'm a part owner. My son went, my daughter went, We founded SchoolNet, let me say briefly, I spent 10 years working for the state legislature in California when it was honest and forthright and true and blue. 10 years for the federal government when it was honest, forthright, true and blue. And 10 years think tanks where I had the opportunity to write books with some distinguished American business leaders. Brad Butler, then CEO of Procter & Gamble, did a book called Investing in Our Children, which is still in print. I get no royalties, so I'm shamelessly promoting it still. Winning the brain race with David Kearns, who went on to become Deputy Secretary of Education under Lamar Alexander, and with Lou Gerstner, who was then head of RJR Nabisco, later went on to become head of IBM, called a book called Reinventing Education. And then 10 years... about 5 years after that in private consulting, and it occurred to me that at the rate we were going as a private consulting operation, it would take about 2,000 or 3,000 years to improve the nation's schools, and was approached by a young man who was a product of the Sloan Media School, MIT Sloan School, the Media Lab actually at MIT, Jonathan Harbor, and he and I decided that we would begin to try to do something serious and systematic about improving American education. So we have started a school improvement company. It's for profit. It is content neutral, and we provide web-enabled services, data warehousing, curricular alignment and assessment, and some other services which we can get into later as the afternoon wears on. But we are convinced that data-driven decision-making is the sine qua non of successful school operations. It is the necessary but not sufficient criterion for success in terms of school improvement. and we are pleased and proud of our customer list. In fact, we think of it as a partner list: Chicago, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Columbus, Philadelphia, soon to add New York to that list, Austin, Texas, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., where I live. The company is headquartered in New York City. We started in the figurative garage 6-7 years ago and have doubled in size every year since then, now up to 110 people with billings of about $20 million a year. And without further ado, I will turn the mic over to my colleague.
I'm Michael Doherty from Kinder Music International. My story probably couldn't be more different than these. I found education sort of by accident, actually. I started out in a very traditional role. After business school here in 88, I went to Bain & Company, spent 3 years there, and made a couple of other stops along the way. And each of those stops kind of defined for me what I didn't like. So for those of you who aren't sure you know what you like, aren't sure if you have a great idea, I had neither of those two things and was able to stumble into something that I think has been really life-changing and rewarding for me, and I think also for our customers and the children that we serve. Kinder Music is the world leader in early childhood music education. So we serve children newborn through 8. We serve about 400,000 children a year in weekly classes held by a licensed educator. And our business really is two things. One, we are a teacher education business, so we have an online learning system where people who have a background in music can learn over a course of 10 weeks to become a music educator for young children. And then we certify them and license them and give them support going forward. We have about 6,000 teachers worldwide in 50 states and 43 countries, and we'll probably train another 1,500 this year. But then the other business we have, which is related and really the one that pays the rent for us, is we are a publisher. So we are a supplemental educational publisher, part of a large industry, actually in the big scope of industry is a tiny industry, but the supplemental ed industry is one that is growing very rapidly. And it's essentially been created because the public education system has not done the job of educating very young children in music that it might. And that's serving us in two ways. One, it's creating music teachers who used to teach in elementary schools and now don't have a place to teach are coming to us and looking for a private sector opportunity. And obviously it's also, with some of the research being done in music and the value for children at a young age, it's fueling a parental demand for what we do. We are a majority woman-owned company. We are a 100% employee-owned company. We have about $20 million of sales this year. And I was brought in as a hired gun in 97. We had about $3 million of sales then, and we've made a lot of changes since then. So we've done a lot, but we have an awful lot more to do. And I used to think we were about one mistake from hitting the top of the trees with the plane. I think we're now maybe two mistakes from doing that.
Terrific. As you can see, I think we have a terrific panel. We span everything from work from pre-K to post-secondary. Individuals have come into this from the business side and from the education side, and we should have a good conversation. Started off, let me start with you, Alan. When we think about the current terrain for for-profit education, what does it look like and where is it going?
Well, up until about a year ago, one of the most attractive sectors of the education business from an investor standpoint was for-profit higher education. And a lot of people are not really that familiar with that sector, but there are more than 10 public companies that operate systems of for-profit colleges. The most well-known company is University of Phoenix, which actually is part of the Apollo Group, about a $2 billion business. There's another company that's equally large called Career Education Corporation, also about a $2 billion business. They have many, many brands. University of Phoenix only has a couple brands, and so it's much better known. Anyway, that field has been growing like crazy, incredibly profitable, and has now begun to mature and has become a little bit less the darling of Wall Street than it was. But people who invested in the University of Phoenix at the right time did about as well as those who invested at Microsoft at the right time. There's a lot of activity right now providing supplemental services to public schools for No Child Left Behind stuff. A lot of companies have been created and have grown really, really quickly in that area. Despite all the different flaws with No Child Left Behind, I think this is a pretty interesting and positive development that so many resources have gone into supplemental education for public school kids. And it'll be interesting to see how that market shakes out and how quality starts to improve and consistency improves in that. You know, my first business, SCORE Educational Centers, you know, a national chain of after-school learning centers. When I opened it, it didn't really appear to be a market for for the concept. There wasn't anyone doing it exactly. That's something I would just say that was echoed in my experience with my second company, Inside Track, where, you know, if you can identify a problem and you can identify a mission that's really close to your heart, you can oftentimes create an opportunity where there may not may not be an obvious one. So, you know, I guess that's my answer. The big opportunities for profit education, supplemental services to public schools, also just after-school type programs, stuff like that. But, you know, I would encourage you to, if you can identify a serious problem and you have a passion to solve it, you can probably create a business around it.
Bridget, now you're working school networks directly in the K-12, selling into public school districts, historically a tough market to work in. Additions, emendations to Alan's point about what the future looks like in this regard?
And I think there are a variety of areas where we'll see a lot of growth in terms of for-profit education. Services is one of those areas. You know, any K-12 school district, irregardless of its size, has a lot of services, programs that they need to administer. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. There are a lot of great people in those districts, and a lot of them are trained in what they're doing, and a lot of them are asked to take jobs that they're not well trained in what to do. It's you always have a mixed plate in a public institution. And so we're seeing more and more services programs developing where you can sell into a district a specific service and expertise. An interesting one is the BLE group that does timeshare for CIOs, so chief information officers, where a district that may be a small, even a mid-size, unless you're a really large district, you don't have the funds and the staffing available to have a full-time CIO. So services where you're offering expertise in an area. Also in terms of high-quality teachers and the demand for small, especially small and mid-sized districts, to offer full-service programs, especially at the middle and high school. So AP classes is an area where we've seen a lot of growth in the services provided in distance learning. A school may be too small, a high school may be too small to have a chemistry AP professor, or excuse me, teacher, or a calculus teacher, but they can usually put together, form a consortium, multiple districts can pay for distance education in this type of area, and those have been very successful. The state of California in particular has spent a lot of money over the last 6 years, about $180 million in this particular effort. And the third, I think, is in terms of content, the development of content. In our country, we have there are 21 states that are called adoption states, where textbooks go through a kind of political process to be adopted or listed and approved for sale to districts in the state. And that is really starting to change as we see content be delivered in multiple formats. Electronic content is growing in demand more and more in the K-12 sector. College students have had a wonderful experience and opportunity to use content in multiple formats, to have technology readily available to them, but K-12 students haven't. We're starting to see more and more of that. There's more opportunity for a small science company to deliver a very high quality electronic digital product and get that into a state like California or Texas because of some of the demands that are being made to provide more success for opportunities for students in math and the math and sciences in particular. So content development by some up-and-coming digital companies that our major textbook companies are having a little trouble struggling to get to that point. So I see those as three areas where there's a lot of growth potential.
All right, Dennis, I want to change the direction of the conversation a little bit. I want to focus on the second half. I want to focus on the second half of our topic, social entrepreneurship. When I think about the other half of my life, when I sit over in the School of Education rather than over here in the business school, I think it's fair to say there's some uncertainty in places like the School of Education, among colleagues and among professional educators more generally, maybe even distrust about where all this is taking us. If they were here, they may really want to ask the question, is this really about doing good or making money? How would you respond to that?
It's a little about doing well and doing good. And I think we ought to take a moment of silence, actually, for Peter Drucker, who died yesterday, because Peter Drucker was the person who had the most original insights here. In a case of what I regard as the dog that didn't bark, Americans have had the opportunity to have for-profit education forever. We've always had the opportunity structurally to do that. There are 28,000 private schools in the country, of which fewer than 1,000 are for-profit, and they're not-for-profit for a reason. It's a much more comfortable format if you want to own and operate a school. So I see no real future for full privatization of education, but what I do see is a real future for privatization around the edges. In SchoolNet's case, about $500 billion a year being spent on education, 20 of that is spent on areas that we think are within our area of expertise and an area in which we can help to operate and help improve schooling. I would say, Tony, your Chicago economist colleagues would probably say that for-profit operations are not in conflict with doing good. In fact, to the contrary, are consistent with doing good, because profit makes much more efficient use of resources, and the overall outcome, of course, is that everybody's better off, the provider and the recipient of services. If there is a metaphor for the way in which the relationships should unfold, it is revealed, at least in our case, in the due diligence that Austin, Texas just did on us when they called Philadelphia to see, to get a fix on their vendor, SchoolNet. And Philadelphia's response is, we don't have a vendor called SchoolNet, we have a partner called SchoolNet. And I think that's the way in which it should be thought of.
Michael, pushing on this theme a bit more, are there special leverage points, places where business can really add value to the work of schools, education more generally, maybe places where thinking about this from a for-profit perspective doesn't make sense? I mean, I think actually Dennis identified one, that the idea that companies actually running schools for profit, at least in the K-12 sector, if I've got you right, is probably not a growth enterprise, if I'm summarizing your point. But you know, let's maybe if we can stick with this theme a bit more.
Well, I think, you know, in our case, we're not serving the schools per se. In effect, what we're trying to do is take people that were active in the schools as music teachers, or maybe who were not active at all as a teacher, and set them up as entrepreneurs. So while, in effect, I'm a social entrepreneur and every one of our employee owners is, what our mission really is to create social entrepreneurs for our 6,000 teachers. And that is yeoman's work in one regard, because to try to take somebody who has teaching expertise and to also blend that with a business expertise and give them enough skills to be able to be self-sufficient to start up and run their own program. All of our programs of Kinder Music are independent from the company, although we give them, in effect, kind of franchise-level support on the business side. I think that's a particular leverage point where business makes education more effective, because the public school sector really has not served music education well in the early childhood space. And so in combination with our business skills and the educational curriculum that we're creating, we're creating a way to serve those children anyway. I mean, in effect, we sort of invented that space 20 years ago. Now we have many imitators, but I think the combined effect is to provide a life for music that maybe keeps it from being the next Latin. You know, we don't want music to be snuffed down in the lives of children, and that's our driving mission.
First, everybody who works in education, I think, thinks about themselves as about social betterment. That's why you don't go in to get rich, that's for sure. But now we have this phrase, social entrepreneurs, and each of you are doing that, trying to, in my view, do good while also stay in business so you can do more good. What does it mean to each of you to be a social entrepreneur? And it's an open question.
Well, I would take Peter Drucker's original admonition about Say's Law. Say created the term entrepreneur for a reason and needed it in the worst way. It's a neologism. And Say's Law is that supply creates its own demand. And an entrepreneur is somebody who creates a good, a service, or an idea that nobody knows they need. The fax machine, the cell phone, the Xerox machine. These are ideas that would never have come out of the public sector, because the public sector is understandably conservative. Chesterton says that democracy is traditions of democracy are the dead, and that's nowhere more evident than in public service activities like public schooling. And it's probably appropriate that public schooling be conservative and does not be subject to vicissitudes and fads at the moment. But public schooling to improve needs the entrepreneurship of people with new ideas, flexibility, agility, imagination, energy, a willingness to run risks. and also a desire to make a little money.
I would just add, you know, I think the idea of entrepreneurship is part of education. Is you go in any kindergarten classroom and ask the teacher where they got their art supplies, where they got the help to put on the after the pageant or the parade in the afternoon, who are the volunteers in their classroom and how do they have so many? They've come up, you know, they've have to go out there and find ways to solve, to fill a need that they've had. I think that, in general, a lot of educators do this, so it's not, you know, it's not uncommon.
The people here on this panel are very concerned about making a profit with their business. In fact, they probably have some very important responsibilities to shareholders and to employees to make their businesses very successful. But I think one of the ways in which the social part of the social entrepreneurship figures into it is simply at the root of what choice did you originally make as to what you want to do with your life? I mean, it's you know, to the extent that you're, you know, to what extent are you incorporating your own personal values about how you'd like to make the world better into other aspects of your life where you're also working to meet your needs in other ways. So, you know, just going back, Tony, when you were asking about kind of, there's a question about kind of the purity of motives in the for-profit education space. You know, what you said is correct. There's very, you know, if you just want to make a buck, I wouldn't really suggest that you get into the education business, but you can still be very successful in it. And if it also is a satisfying and fulfilling thing for you to do, then it's a great choice. And, you know, again, when you talk, when you think about, when I hear that question about purity of motives in the business world, I always want to answer, well, compared to what? You know, if any of you have experience working with government education organizations or nonprofit education organizations, there are many, many different things that drive decision making in those organizations, and they are not solely focused on the welfare of students. In fact, students are oftentimes the third or fourth on the list. So,
I think that's absolutely right, and I asked the question because my sense was that each of you in some form or another working in this domain have probably confronted that question, and for any of you who are thinking about working in this domain, you will almost invariably confront it, and I think it's important to think through why we're in this, why we waded into this swamp, and what others in this swamp are actually doing alongside of us, and I think your point about purity of motives is suspect broadly.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Bridging the Gap Conference.
Bridging the Gap was the 2005 Net Impact Conference, convened by the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Rob Lepper. Our website editor was Leah Silverman. The series producer is Bernadette Clavier.
This is Chris Steigelmeier
and Eric Nie on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.